On Saturday, April 30th, in the Fullinger Great Hall at Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. The performance will include Schumann's Piano Concerto in A Minor and Serenade No. 1 by Brahms. For more information, call 333-6280.
Good morning, and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Well, this year, once again, Champaign-Urbana and the University of Illinois are hosting Roger Ebert's Overlooked Film Festival. This is the seventh time that we have done it here in Champaign-Urbana. And people from really all over the world, filmmakers, writers, producers, people who write about movies, people who act in them, are here to talk about movies generally and specifically about their work. And this morning on Focus, we're fortunate enough to have, in both hours of the show, some of the guests who are here to attend the festival. And in the first hour here, we'll be talking with director and writer Shane Carruth. His film Primer is one of the movies that will be shown at the festival. It's showing 3 o'clock tomorrow afternoon. So you might have the opportunity to go down there, and if you can get yourself a ticket, you can see it. Otherwise, it is available, has been now just for the past couple of days on DVD. So you can rent the movie if you'd like. And this was his first movie. He is self-taught as a filmmaker and was not a film school guy, but decided he wanted to do a movie and did manage to get this one done. Writing it, directing it, he performed in it, he edited it, he wrote the music, he did just about everything on it. And the film won the Grand Jury Prize at the Sundance Festival last year. So we're pleased to have him here, and if people who are listening maybe would like to ask questions or whatever, you'd like to talk with our guest, you can do that. It's very easy. All you have to do is dial us up here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Sure. Thank you for having me.
As I mentioned, you're not a film school graduate, did not in a formal way study movie making.
That's right. Yeah.
What was it that made you want to make a movie?
It all started with story. I started writing short stories in college. I guess once I got out of school, I worked as a software engineer for a couple of years. And in my spare time, I was consumed with continuing to write. I started working on a novel that I'll never finish. And I think what I learned from that is how taken I am, I guess, with the screenplay format, because you can sort of eliminate internal monologue and you can show what people are thinking or feeling by actions or their surroundings or some other device. And so I concentrated on that format, and I was seeing a lot of films that everyone sees with small budgets but big impact story-wise, and before long I just thought about trying my hand at it. I know In the Company of Men was a film that kind of was a revelation for me, where I saw what you could do with basically two guys talking for 90 minutes, but it was just so well told. I started work on the script for Primer. It was actually, I had written one script before, and I was trying to figure out how to get that one made when the idea for Primer came to me. And I was so taken with the idea for Primer that I pretty much dropped everything that I was doing. I was still working full time, but as far as thinking that I was going to do this production, in my spare time, I kind of dropped that and just concentrated on writing Primer for about a year. And it was good because there was a lot. It ended up being pre-production. I ended up learning a lot in that year that I would have been killed if I tried to do the first production without knowing. And so as I was writing, I was securing locations. And you know, I wouldn't write a scene until I knew that I could secure the proper location for it, and then I could feel comfortable about that. And I would write dolly shots into the script and everything, but I hadn't seen a dolly yet, so I would go to the rental facility and see what they cost and what I can afford and how much track you get with that. And so just piece by piece, over the course of the writing process, I did the pre-production.
Yeah. And that's, as I mentioned, you did all these other facets of the film, including being in it. And essentially, you were also your own producer, because that's kind of the producer's job.
Yeah. You know, I made so much fun, I think, of the term producer before this. Just, you know, what does a producer do? There's kind of a joke about that, really. And now I know. Now I know how invaluable it is to have multiple people, basically, just making sure that tools are available.
Well, can you give the thumbnail sketch, the thumbnail synopsis of what the movie is about?
Sure. I always tell people that it's It's about some guys who have normal white collar jobs during the day, and then at night and on weekends they work together in one of the guys' garage, and they sort of tweak and invent things, and they wind up coming up with something that is too valuable for them to market. And the story is about the repercussions of that and the fallout with their relationships. And it's very coy because it doesn't really say what the device is. But to be honest, you know, the first third of the film is sort of an investigative procedural as to what that thing is. So I, if I can avoid saying what it is, I usually do.
Okay. And where did that idea come from? The basic premise for the movie.
I knew what the story was before. I mean, technically, it ends up being a science fiction film. But I knew thematically what it was and what the characters were going to go through before it had anything to do with science. I was interested in taking a conventional relationship and seeing what happens if you give one of them or both of them a unheard of amount of power, and what that does if it's possible to maintain any sort of relationship, always second guessing the other person. And so that was kind of the framework for it. And at the same time, I was reading a lot of nonfiction about inventions. I was reading this great book about the history of the number zero, of all things. And it touched on so many, points in history, where real invention was occurring. And it just, I guess reading about, Bell Labs last century and just the transistor and everything that came out of there, it just seemed like there were all these commonalities in the way that real invention happens that I felt like I hadn't seen play out on screen. And it was really interesting to me. So I knew that that was kind of my world. And then that premise, and then what I knew the characters were going to be going through pretty much set up the plot and everything.
Did you, when you started reading writing the screenplay, did you go out and get a book on how to write screenplays, or did you have some sort of sense of how it is you do that?
You know, I know I've never finished a book on writing a screenplay. I don't know. I'm just not trusting of books about that, I guess. I know that I've picked them up and I've looked at them, but it just, I don't know, something about it seems wrong. It just feels like, you know, if you have complaints about the way that movies are today, that they, you know, they all seem to be the same or follow the same structure, then why would you want to add to that? And that's kind of the way I felt. When I did finish the script, I gave it to a friend, and he said, yeah, I think it's interesting. It doesn't really follow a three act structure though. And I was like, yeah. And I didn't realize that he was saying that as something I needed to fix immediately. Like it needs to be a three act structure. And I don't know, I just kind of came at it from the viewpoint of, okay, great, we're all expecting a three-act structure. So now that we know that, maybe if you're delivered something that isn't that, maybe it'll be the first, you know, surprise you've seen in a long time. So I just kind of threw all that other stuff out and just wanted to write what I found interesting.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is filmmaker Shane Carruth, writer-director. His movie Primer is one of the films that will be shown as part of Roger Ebert's Overlooked Film Festival. That's tomorrow afternoon at 3 at the Virginia Theater. It is also available as DVD now if you'd like to look at it. And questions, too, are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, once you got the screenplay done, or substantially done, then it was time to start thinking about making the movie. How did you, you've probably seen lots of movies, like we've all seen lots of movies, but if it was me, I'm not sure I would have any idea how to actually go about it or where I would even start. How did you try to figure out what it was that you needed to do actually to go from a piece of paper to,
right,
to the movie?
A lot of that also was done in the writing process. I did a lot of things. I audited a film course at a local college in Dallas. That lasted about 2 weeks, and it was pretty cool. We disassembled a camera and loaded a mag, and learned a little bit about f-stops, and that was really great, very interesting to me. And then it sort of became a theory course on the professor's favorite films, and so we watched a lot of John Waters films. And it got to the point where I felt like I'm not learning the basics of what I need to learn. I mean, this is great. If I'm going to spend 4 years in school, this is probably great stuff to learn, but I needed to move on. So I started going to production companies in town, basically just going door to door. And I would ask the post-production facilities all the questions I could about what I need to send to them or get to them so that they can get me something to edit, and, you know, what editing systems are available, and just basically putting together an entire production or getting together the information for an entire production by going door to door. And I could get, you know, some information out of them before they realized that, that I don't have any money that day for them. So they would move, they would point me to someone else. I did a lot of that and did a lot of, testing. I was really, intimidated by cinematography. You know, it's so expensive to shoot film, that I tried to take it apart, and what I ended up doing is shooting 35 millimeter stills, just taking an old 35 millimeter still camera. And I bought some tungsten, film, which is, you know, most motion picture film is tungsten based, at least for indoor, shots. And so I bought some of that film from a specialty shop, and I just went out and started taking storyboards, really, doing different lighting setups. And, you know, I have my mom standing in as the characters or myself standing in, just to do different lighting setups on their, on their faces versus backgrounds and stuff. And, so that helped a lot. I, you know, by the end of that, I felt like I was less intimidated by cinematography and I, not only that, but I had these storyboards to kind of show anybody who was going to get involved from that point forward, whether it was actors or actually going into a film transfer, a place I could kind of negotiate, hopefully, a better rate by showing them that, look, here, you know, you take the script and you take these images and you, this is what the movie's going to be. So, and, you know, it was maybe one step up from being a kid off the street saying, I'm going to make a movie. So I just tried to piece it together as well as I could.
Yeah. So you had, by doing the storyboarding, then you had a rough idea of what it would look like, how the shots were going to be set up and so forth. One of the things that I read, though, is that you didn't do, I think, did you do just one take?
That's
of
right.
Everything?
Yeah, there's something called a shooting ratio, which is basically the amount of film that you shoot versus what actually ends up in the final film. We had a 2-to-1 shooting ratio, which is just nothing because the only thing that's left is the slate and something called, you know, rollout, which is basically just, you know, bad film at the end of a roll that you can't even use anyways. We not only did we only shoot one take of everything, but, you know, within a scene, if you're going to see 7 different shots. We only shot the lines for any given angle. There is no coverage. There is basically only one way to edit each of the scenes for the most part, with very little overlap.
Well, now that I could imagine either that would make editing easier because it didn't give you a lot of choice or it would make it really hard because it didn't give you a lot of choice.
Exactly. And that's the thing is it's both. For the most part, it saves money. It saves time. But when there is a problem, a continuity error, you know, an actor has his arm at his side in one shot, and then in the next shot, it's up above his head. That's an impossible cut without being completely jarring. And so, you know, you find yourself, instead of spending hours making decisions on how to edit and timing, it's weeks because now you're looking at, is there any second where his back is turned, where I can make his line fit there and we can push that line, make it go a little bit faster and get the actor in and we'll dub it. And it just becomes this jigsaw puzzle without enough pieces. And so getting it back into a form where the same information is delivered is very time consuming.
How long did it take to edit it?
It took 2 years.
That's a long time.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that also includes the composing the music and doing Foley work and dubbing and everything.
Yeah. Did it really only cost $7,000?
Yeah. You know, it up until the time where it got into Sundance, it cost $7,000. In order to have something to present at the festival, I blew it up from the original Super 16 film to 35 millimeter. That process cost about $30,000. But that's the last money that was spent, by me. I know the distributor is obviously had a marketing campaign or whatever, but, that's the budget. I mean, doesn't account for anybody's time or swindling of free things, but, that's the money. Yeah.
Well, that's, I think probably of low budget movies. That's the lowest budget I think I've ever seen for a movie. I mean, there are some people who have said, oh, I made a movie for $10,000 and that seemed like not very much money, but $7,000. And I suppose the fact that you did so much of the work yourself, acting, producing, writing, editing, doing all that kind of stuff, probably cut down on, you would not have had to pay if you had had the money to pay somebody else to do that job. And I suppose, did the actors get paid?
Nobody's been paid yet. Everybody's working on a kind of a deferred basis. So.
Another thing that I read about the movie is that how you ended up being in the movie as an actor was that you had spent a lot of time, saw a lot of actors, only cast one of the leads. You just got so tired, you said, maybe I'll just do it myself. Is that really how it was?
We did 5 casting calls, and you know, I actually just had a hard time getting people to show up prepared. I'd never done casting calls before, and so I was trying to cover all my bases. And I was actually, once people signed up for auditions, I would actually call them personally to make sure that they actually had the material that we were going to be trying out with. Mm-hmm. And in some cases, I'd be driving across town all day just to deliver this. And for some reason, I could not. When people showed up, they were still, you know, they would read off the page, and then they would look up and to make eye contact, I guess, because maybe their coach told them to do that, and then they look right back at the page, and it was just. I couldn't see anything. I didn't have the ability to discern whether I was looking at somebody who could do it or not. So I'd ask them to come back a couple of days later. And again, I just, for some reason, I couldn't get them prepared. And so David Sullivan, he did it. And, I tried out over 100 people for the two lead male roles. And, I was able to find him, but not anybody else. Mm. And at that point, I was kind of, I had memorized a good portion of the script myself just to kind of show by example what I was looking for. And at one point I wanted to, make the number of people who can break this thing if they walk away. I wanted to make that number as small as I could get. So I figured, well, I'll be there every time we shoot. It's one less person I have to call every day. So I'll just step into it. Mm.
Did you, when you were having people show up to read for the parts, did they know that there was no money?
Yeah. And that's the thing. I should have said that. That's probably the biggest reason why it was difficult. It's weird because there is a whole, there's a whole level of, films that are being made and actors that are trying to get work that, you know, there is no money and they're just hoping to build kind of a resume and get projects on the back of their headshot or whatever. But yeah, I wasn't offering to pay. So I don't know why I expected so much from them.
They didn't really take it all that seriously because they figured even if they got cast, they might end up being in a movie, but yeah. That they, other than that, they weren't really going to get anything out of it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I don't know if I would have been any different showing up to try out for some guy who's never made a film before and, you know, reading weird lines about science and stuff.
Yeah. Once you get a movie made, then the next big challenge is getting it shown, getting it distributed. And nowadays, one of the things that you can do is you can go someplace like Sundance, because even if you're an unknown filmmaker and this is the first movie, if you can get some attention and you can get people to say, yeah, this is a good movie, you can win a prize, then that's something. And people, of course, now potential distributors know that there are films there to be had and that there is now a record now of people of distributors making some serious money on movies that didn't cost very much to make and then for them didn't cost very much to acquire, but ended up being very popular with audiences and ending up making a lot of money because their production costs were pretty low. So that's kind of what you got to do these days. Did you just think to yourself, the place where I want to go is Sundance and hopefully people will see the movie and it'll get somebody interested?
I actually held out for Sundance. It was just another naive thing because there was no reason for me to think that it was going to be accepted to that festival. They get so many submissions and, mm-hmm. you know, they can only take so many. I think I finished in August of 2003 and met their early submission. And I knew that I wouldn't hear from them until the end of November. But I withheld it from other festivals that were sort of interested, just holding out for Sundance. I don't know why I thought, but I did.
Well, it did worked out pretty well.
Yeah, no, I feel very fortunate. Yeah.
Our guest, let me just again introduce for this first part of Focus 580 is filmmaker Shane Carruth. His movie Primer, his first movie, is one of the films being shown this weekend as part of Roger Ebert's Overlooked Film Festival. You can see it at the Virginia Theater, 3 p.m. Saturday afternoon. I think that there are a limited number of tickets available. If you don't see it that way, there is also now a DVD that's available of the movie. And if you have questions, you can certainly give us a call, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Wonder if you can give us some sense of what, for somebody like you who's got a movie, maybe it's your first movie, and you're really hoping that it can get some attention and get picked up, what's the festival experience, what Sundance is like?
For me, it was nerve-wracking because, you know, I found out that it was going to be able to play in the festival about a month before it was supposed to be presented. And I didn't have a print and really didn't know about the mechanics of making a print. And so I frantically went to Los Angeles and got that process done. And it was really, it was a full-time job every day between then, excuse me, and the festival. And so even... It showed five times at the festival, or it was supposed to, and then it actually showed a few more. But by the first time that it showed, it was about, that was about 24 hours after it was officially a print. And so it was still wet, basically, by the time it showed up. Yeah. And I was very nervous that it was going to be, you know, it came in five reels, and I had this nightmare that they were going to assemble it wrong, where you see reel one, but then reel three, and then two, and then four, and five. And I was just scared about that. So, the first screening, it was all about technical stuff. And there actually were a couple problems. There was a few missing seconds between reel one and reel two. So I was trying to talk to the projectionist to try and get all that figured out. And for the first couple of days, that was my whole life, is just, you know, running around trying to deal with technical things, on top of the fact that, you know, you're expected to do a Q&A after each screening. And with a film like this, the plot gets very complicated pretty fast, especially towards the end. And I was very worried that the Q&As were going to turn into nothing but different, you know, talking about different plot points and what makes sense and what doesn't. Yeah. And, you know, as a, you know, filmmaker, I'm so much more interested in the subtext and all the, you know, thematic stuff that we're doing. And I was sort of worried about that, but it ended up being great. And, I don't know, the rest of the week it was, I mean, still mind numbingly, I was anxious, but, it was very good. I was very lucky to be there. I know that. Mm.
Did you get a lot of people wanting to pick up the film and do the distribution?
Not a lot. Before the award ceremony at the end, where it ended up getting the grand jury prize, I think there were three distributors that were interested, and they weren't the Miramaxes or the, you know, Lionsgates or whatever of the world. It was some smaller companies, but there was some interest.
Yeah. I've read several reviews of the movie with reviewers who said something like, I didn't understand this movie, or there are some things that I didn't understand. Now, and in fairness, I would say that I think some of those reviewers also said they liked the movie, but that they found the plot, as you say, it's complicated. And even I think I read a comment in one of the things that I read about you that said that you think probably a lot of people will not completely understand the story with just one viewing, that you might have to look at it more than once.
Well, yeah. I mean, the thing, if you're looking for every plot point and detail to add up, there is no scene at the end that does that for you. Mm. So if that's what you're into, then unfortunately it's not in your face. So you might want to see it again if you're into it. The thing, I was much more interested in what's happening to these characters and what's, you know, what the allegory is, as opposed to, and that's so hard to talk about without actually talking about the devices, but, as opposed to just every little detail and stuff. The thing is, what these guys end up doing with this device and their levels of basically betrayal, their motivation is based in their inability to know certain things. So my thinking was that we will always be with these guys as an audience, that we will only know what they know. And so unfortunately there's a limit to how much they have the ability to know about any given moment in the film. And so I've made sure that it all adds up and that the information is there. Mm-hmm. But it's not summed up.
Does the idea that it is somewhat mysterious, not completely obvious, does that appeal to you? Did the idea of making a movie like that appeal to you from the start, or did that just happen because of the story and the way the story developed?
Maybe both. I mean, I know that I had a choice to sum it up at the end. You know, as complicated as it is, you can always do something at the end where some guy has an emotional breakdown and explains the entire plot to you. That's always possible. Or, you know, some other device. I'm sort of making fun, I guess. But, and I chose not to, because I guess, you know, that's the kind of film that I like to see. My favorite films, you know, when I walk away from them, I feel like I've seen a core part of the story. But if I happen to take another look, I realize that there was some other stuff going on there. Yeah. So I guess I just didn't shy away from it. Yeah.
Well, I think that it can be, there is something that's much more engaging about a story that's not where every last thing isn't tied up for you, that you can spend some time thinking about it or puzzling about it. And the idea of having everything, having somebody make a speech. Like, for example, it wasn't very long ago that I saw Psycho, and I hadn't seen it in a long, long time. And probably a lot of people kind of know the story and know what the deal is. And I guess I had forgotten about the fact that you sort of go through the whole movie, and then at the very end, there's a character who has never appeared before in the film, who is a psychiatrist who has spent some time interviewing Norman Bates to figure out what the whole deal is. And then he essentially gives a monologue, and it's really rather long, where he explains his psychology, what actually happens. And there's something about that that's kind of unsatisfying in a way, that you had gotten the whole thing. And then at the end, somebody has to stand up and deliver a several minute long discourse about what it was that you had just seen.
Right. It removes any amount of credibility or whatever that you give to the audience for trying to figure out something on their own. It pretty much removes that. It's almost like taking this great compliment away at the end of a film sometimes.
Yeah. And I guess, you know, just to me, it's sort of more fun wrestling with things. I think of movies that there are certain movies perhaps that I have seen that maybe for a couple of days afterwards, it's almost that I cannot stop thinking about them, because I continue to think about certain things and try to explain to myself what the story was and various plot points. I guess that just for me that adds to my enjoyment of the movie. And if it's something that essentially you see the movie and 5 minutes later you've forgotten it, and instead of talking about the movie, you're talking with whoever we're with about where we're going to go for dinner.
Right.
Then it seems to me that movie, as entertaining as it might have been, and you might say, okay, that was worth my $7, that somehow it's not maybe what movies are capable of doing for you.
Right.
Yeah. So what are you working on now?
I am writing now and trying to figure out whether I get to be a filmmaker. I'm not sure.
You're not sure?
I'm not sure. There's definitely a way, but there's a way for me to be a hired hand, I think, at this point, to show up and be bossed around by producers and studios, and kind of just show up and be a face, basically, more than anything. And I think that's possible because of how fortunate I was with having the film distributed. But I guess if I wanted to do that, I would probably just be a software engineer, and the stories are too important to me to have them, I don't know, torn apart by the system the way it is.
Would you be satisfied writing screenplays and having somebody else make the movies?
No. I don't know. I know that it's obviously that's the way it's usually done, and it works well a lot of times. But I have a pretty strong opinion about a singular vision and writing something that I know I'll be directing. I mean, as I'm writing, I try to keep the notes off into the side, but I'm directing it. I'm figuring out where the camera's going. I'm figuring out what we're seeing and what we're hearing at any given moment. So I don't know. I've tried to talk to writers about how do you write without inferring your own direction. I don't even see how it's possible, and vice versa. I don't see how you can direct material that you're not 100% sure where it originated. That, I mean, I know that it's cool to have a collaborative process, but for me, it's just both sides of that are so much work that I want to know exactly where it's coming from, where it's going.
Yeah. Well, in the way that often movies get written these days, you may have a whole bunch of people. You may have one person do a script, and then somebody else takes it and does a revision, and somebody else takes that and does a revision, and maybe somebody else takes that and does a revision. It may pass through several hands and may end up being something really different at the end than it was from the start. So there can't be much in the way of consistent vision if something like that
happens. Exactly. And that's I think you can get some great fun movies from that, sure, but if you're looking for substance or any kind of allegory or symbolism or whatever, how can you trust that the thing that, you know, this riddle that you're looking at and you're inferring things about, I don't trust that anymore once it's been filtered through so many hands, because I know that it's changing not because not because it's staying thematically pure, but because some guy had to insert his, he had to justify his job and kind of and tweak something, or an actor was cast, and so suddenly we need to make his character more likable or something like that.
Well, we have a caller here. We'll bring him into the conversation, and other people who are listening certainly are welcome to call. Let me introduce again the guest, Shane Carruth. He's the director, the writer, the editor, the producer, one of the stars, composed the music for the film Primer, his very first, and that is one of the movies being shown as part of Roger Ebert's Overlooked Film Festival. That's showing tomorrow afternoon at 3 at the Virginia Theater. It's also out now on DVD. He won the Grand Jury Prize at the Sundance Film Festival last year for the movie and is here. A lot of other people have come here for the festival. People to come have come talked about movies they're in, movies they've made, and movies generally. That's sort of what the festival is all about. So questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We have a caller here in Belgium nearby, line number 4. Hello.
Yes, good morning. Mm-hmm. Kind of hard to ask you a question about the film that you really only made very passing remarks to.
He's being kind of cagey about the whole thing,
yeah,
isn't
you
he?
Really, yeah. You really are.
Sorry about that.
But probably the question that needs to be asked is, if you, I'm not going to be able to get over to your showing there, but how do you get this DVD?
It should be widely available. It came out Tuesday, and even I wasn't really sure how widely available it was going to be. So I basically had my friend in San Antonio, I had him go to a Blockbuster, and I went to a Blockbuster in Dallas and a Hollywood Video and a couple other video places, and my girlfriend called her hometown in Louisiana, and my parents called their parents, and just to kind of do a rough study. And it looks like on average every Blockbuster has, you know, 4 or 5 copies. So,
well, that's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's available. Mm-hmm. I'm not aware of any marketing that would let people know about that other than internet stuff, but it's definitely, you know, one of those weird copies you see at Blockbuster and wonder why there's a box on the cover.
One that might be in.
Yeah, yeah, I believe so.
Thank you very much, sir.
Sure, thank you.
Well, I'm sure that having won the prize at Sundance, that helps because then it gets attention and people will want to see that movie. And I would think that Blockbuster and places like that would expect people would be coming in looking for the movie so that they would want to have it, even though it's an offbeat, not a major studio thing, not a big commercial kind of movie.
Right. I don't, it's very weird. It's hard for me to figure out what to expect from it. I mean, I know I was talking to the distributor a month or so ago, and they said that, no, don't expect it to see it at Blockbuster. We'll be very lucky if they're interested in even a
really?
Small share. And yeah, well, I mean, I don't know if that was, now it's going through a sub-distributor, so it's going through, Think Film was the theatrical distributor, and now I think they are sub-distributing it through New Line, and so I guess New Line is better connected or something. I'm not sure, but for whatever reason, it's actually, yeah, it's available. I was pretty surprised about that.
Okay, so chances are, if you go down to wherever you rent videos, you should be able to find the DVD, a Primer, and I suppose if they don't have it, you could ask them to get it.
Sure. Well, yeah, I mean, if you really care, it's available on to order. Online.
Yeah, I'm sure you can go out and buy yourself a copy. Go through your favorite online seller. You can do that. I know this is a really rude thing to ask, but you know, we talked about the fact that the movie cost $7,000 to make, and then you had to spend a lot more money to get it blown up into the print to show at Sundance.
Right.
What do you have some sort of feeling like eventually how much you'll make from the movie?
No, I don't. And it's a point of frustration. Figuring out, I don't know. You know, we structured a deal with a distributor that was, you know, gave up any upfront money so that we could participate more in the back end. I mean, I know what's due out of that deal. The problem is now is, it's very difficult to get information on DVD sales, for example. I read this horrible article about how Peter Jackson is having to sue New Line over the Lord of the Rings DVDs because he's claiming that.
Even a big shot like
yeah,
that?
Yeah, somebody that you would think that they would be doing anything they can to keep happy is somehow suing, and you know, who knows who's right in that situation. But it's very scary because it sounds like there's not any, you know, you want box office, you can sort of trust that Variety's numbers are relatively in the ballpark. And there's even sources on the internet where you can get good numbers. For a DVD, apparently, it's just difficult to get. You know, there's only the distributor sort of knows, and they keep it close to the vest. So.
Well, I think that isn't that one of the criticisms that has been made about big studios particularly is that they're very reluctant to tell you really how much movies make, how much money they make, and it it seems fairly routine that people are coming along afterwards. Maybe people have been in movies, people have made movies, who said, "Look, you claim the movie made this much money, and I got this much money, but I really think that you made a lot more money than this, and you're not being square about how much money you big studio made on the movie."
It's very weird. Like, you know, in other industries, there's a level of transparency that's necessary to do business properly and to stay competitive. It's weird that either it's going to eventually be better, or they have such a stranglehold on their system that they actually can mandate this sort of stuff and keep it so quiet. I honestly don't know yet. I'm still sort of learning.
Champagne, here we have another caller, someone locally, and that's line one. Hello.
Yes, let's see. You talked about the sort of wanting to keep the vision that you had in mind when writing the script and also when directing it. I was just thinking of a scene that I admired very much. Can I describe it? I think it won't give anything away.
Sure.
Where the engineers are sitting around the table in the kitchen discussing, and we see the wife of one of them, you know, very much seeming in the background, working in the kitchen. And then you have the camera withdraw into the dark living room, and now we see the engineers in one pool of light and the wife working in the other pool of light. And suddenly she's not in the background at all. You know, she's very much in a different world, but just as important as they are. I just admired that so much.
Oh, thank you so much. Yeah, there's a lot of that in the film. It starts off being about basically four engineers, and then Aaron, who's one of the two lead guys, he has a wife that the caller's talking about. And it starts off being about a group of people. And as the film moves along, the two leads characters, Abe and Aaron, they sort of isolate themselves from you start to see less and less of the wife and the kid. And then they've purposely separated themselves from the other two engineers in the garage and even made up reasons to kind of separate them from the work, and by the end of it there's an even more isolated feeling where it's Abe and Aaron find themselves actually cutting themselves off from each other, and so there is sort of that isolating effect. So that's kind of the way that scene is shot that he's describing is sort of, you know, the foreshadowing for that.
Thanks.
All right, sure, thank you. Well, again, other folks who are listening, if you have questions, comments, you want to call in, 333-9455. That's for Champaign Urbana, toll free, 800-222-9455. And our guest is film director, writer Shane Kruth. His film Primer, his first movie, won the Grand Jury Prize at Sundance 2004, is available now on DVD, and is one of the movies showing at Roger Ebert's Overlook Film Festival coming up this weekend. There are so many people who would like to make movies. So many people who would really be happy to be where you are. And you sort of wonder, do you think that the fact that you actually managed to get your movie made and it turned out pretty well and it got the prize and it's now distributed and you're, you know, maybe on your way to doing this for a living, to be involved in films one or another, is just a matter of luck? I mean, some days you just wake up and think, man, how in the world did that happen, when there are so many other people who would really like to be able to do the same thing?
Right. Yeah. I mean, I know a certain amount of it is, just like I was talking about submitting to Sundance. I mean, it really all kind of started there. They get, I forget the number, it's somewhere between 600 and 1,000 submissions. And you know, they can't, we were actually talking about this yesterday during the panel, but they can't possibly have their six programmers look at all of these films. So they obviously have this kind of intern system where they have volunteers look at things and then pass on the things that they like. So you're right up against their sensibilities. And if the guy that you get isn't into your kind of storytelling, yeah, you could be cut off soon. So I know that there's always an amount of luck, or there was, for getting into that. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I know that I won some kind of a lottery. I don't, you know, it's always a mixture of stuff. I think the film's a good film. And I think eventually it would have been found on some level, but yeah. But I know that I lucked out there.
Well, I mean, I don't want to make it sound like just luck. And because I sort of have this belief that it wouldn't, if it was not a good film, and I've read a lot of reviews, I must be honest, and I'll be honest with people who are listening, I have not myself been able to see the film, but I've read a lot about it and I've read a lot of reviews, and the reviews were generally positive and what was written about the film was positive. So as I sort of have this feeling that if the film wasn't good and you didn't have enough people liking it, it wouldn't have gotten, it's not just luck, but you know, I'm sure that there is a matter of you get a break here and a break there, and then that sort of makes the difference between keeping going and somehow running up against a wall that you can't get past.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's always a mixture.
We have somebody here on a cell phone on our toll free line. We'll talk with them. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks.
I'm a musician, a composer, and I've done countless things on spec. Some things that enjoyed a little bit of notoriety, some things that kind of went by the wayside. And I'm wondering, you may have already talked about this and I missed it, but is there some sort of monetary, is there money involved with the prize that was won?
Not with the Grand Jury Prize at Sundance. There was another award there called the Alfred P. Sloan Award that the film won, and that actually did come with some money for the writer and director. So luckily, I split that with myself, and so that's the reason that I get to come to festivals rather than being a full time software engineer right now, at least for the next month or two.
Did you? I mean, being on the other end and. Being, you know, the musician who, like actors, are out there trying to do things that are creative. It's kind of a sensitive question, but, I mean, did you make sure that you tried to put some money in the pockets of some of these people that sacrificed their time and effort?
Yeah, I mean, it's as soon as... we'll all see money at the same time, I guess, is what I'm saying. There is an ownership, at least, you know, the people that were involved for the full shoot. They will definitely, the first second that money comes in, everyone will see a share of it.
Are you going to try and make sure that those people get paid before you?
I hadn't thought about that. No, I think it'll probably all happen at the same time. The money all comes to an account, and then it's split up. They have their share and I have mine. So, I mean, I don't know. There's not really a before or after. I mean, I don't know what you're like. I borrowed for the blow up, the $30,000 for the blow up. I had to borrow that from a friend, and I set up a deal where basically he's going to see the first money just because, you know, everybody else, of course, I appreciate their time and they were volunteering on a kind of, you know, basis where they knew how risky it was and doing it for, you know, the learning experience as well. And whereas this guy who Scott Douglas is his name, he ponied up $30,000, which is not easy to do. And he had to have a lot of faith in the film.
Right.
So he's obviously going to get his money back first. I don't know. I think I'm going to shy away from this, though. I'm probably saying too much about people's personal details, but.
Well, it's just something that I've been involved with so many times that it just always feels good, even a small amount, when you're putting your heart and soul into something that you're totally working on spec. And then when something like this pops, I think people get forgotten. And I don't hear that in your voice. I hear that, and I don't know you, but I feel that you're going to take care of these people. And I just think it's so important that these people get taken care of, because I know a lot of people don't.
No, absolutely. Yeah. Well, the coolest thing is, you know, and the crew was so small, and that was really horrible on everybody involved during the shoot. But I did get us all in for a crew commentary, because it was so important to me to just kind of have it documented, because I don't know. Unfortunately, if you look at the end credits for Primer, I made sure that the crew is actually listed first before the cast, because it's so frustrating to me to see movies where, you know, somebody who like an actress who came in and worked for 2 days is listed far above and in prominence, well above like the gaffers or a guy who ran camera, you know, sweating for 5 weeks. It just didn't make any sense. So, I mean, I've tried to do everything I can to kind of show like, you know, the amount of work that was done by this crew is far out more outweighs anything that was in the cast or whatever. And so I made sure that they're all the entire crew, except for one guy who couldn't make it, 'cause he actually works in film, were all involved in the crew commentary. And I don't know, that's not like it's compensation, but I thought it was pretty cool.
You sound, you know, smart enough, and it sounds like you've made enough notes that everybody will get covered, but it just being on the other end of it and watching some things that I've done become quite successful and never seeing a penny, I don't know. It's just a very personal thing, and it's just a question I needed to ask.
Sure. Yeah, sure. Thank you.
Okay. Other folks here, if you want to give us a call, we have maybe about 5 minutes left talking with filmmaker Shane Carruth. He's here for the Roger Ebert's Overlooked Film Fest, and his movie, his first movie, is being shown. You talked a little bit earlier about the fact that you want to continue to be involved in film, and that you would be happy to have a lesser role. You know that you're still feeling like you're learning the craft, and you'd be happy to be involved in movies and, you know, do the behind the scenes stuff. Now, because you've made the movie and it has got some attention, though, are people approaching you and saying, well, we'd give you the chance to write, or we'd give you the chance to direct again, or are you having to still seek out the opportunities yourself?
I actually have an agent, which is the weirdest. It's still weird for me to even think about that. I get sent scripts. He gets sent scripts through other production companies and studios and stuff, and they send them to me. And for the last year, I've read a lot of the stuff that they send me, pretty much knowing that it is important for me to write and direct. So, but I wanted to see what I was saying no to, I guess. Mm-hmm. And I've basically reached the point where, yeah, I mean, it will be my own thing. And there is a pretty easy way to sell out, I think, at this point. The idea that I'm writing now, there's definitely the possibility for me to option the idea so that I'm basically getting paid to write. And I, as poor as I am, I have somehow found the nerve or whatever to kind of hold off and just continue writing without being told what I need to write or having it go through some kind of filter. And I don't know how it's going to work out. I think I have a plan that's going to work, that's going to get an adequate budget, and get a film made that people will be proud of. I don't know. It's risky because I can see how easy it would be just to say, you know, yes, please. And then there's an entire structure set up to get a film made with little thought on the part of the director or writer.
Well, that's it. You're being in a tough position because, after all, you've got to live. You got to pay your rent. You got to buy groceries. You know, you got to have enough money to survive.
Right.
And I guess there would be only so long that you could feel like you could go on without having any income, unless you had, you know, you were doing something else to support yourself, basically just to live on, so that then you could do this thing that you really wanted to do.
Right. I'm lucky, and I think cursed with this insane idealism I have with story. And I would rather be a software engineer being bossed around and told what to do instead of being bossed around about a story, because it means too much to me to have it affected. Does anybody watch this program on Bravo called Project Greenlight?
I know about it. I guess I've seen some of it. It's what it is. It's a reality show that's following some people that are trying to get movies made.
Oh my gosh! I never planned to watch it because I always think, okay, I watched it last year, I'm not going to watch it this year. I can't go through that again. And then I start watching it again because it's such a great a great view into the world of what an actual production is like.
So you think it's really, it shows you what it really is like.
My experience so far with, you know, directors and writers basically being hired hands and not necessarily, at least what I thought a director did. It's exactly what I've seen. They have very little.
Well, we certainly wish you the best.
Well, thank you very much.
Future success. And I want to say again that our guest here for this hour, Shane Carruth, he is the director, the writer. The movie is Primer. It is showing as part of Roger Ebert's Overlooked Film Festival tomorrow afternoon at 3:00 at the Virginia Theater, and there probably still are some tickets. You might have to go stand in line for tickets, but it is maybe still possible for you to get in the festival. But it is also now available as a DVD, so that you can, chances are, if you go down to your local Blockbuster or some, wherever it is you go, to rent your movies, you should be able to find it, and you can look at it that way. The film won the Grand Jury Prize at Sundance last year, 2004. And Shane, he wrote, directed, he performed in the movie, he edited, he composed the music, he did his own production.
So pretentious. So I
probably
swear
did the catering too.
My parents, yeah, my parents actually did the catering.
Oh, they did. So they made sure that the performers got, everybody got fed.
Yeah, it was the only thing that worked properly on the whole shoot.
But, all right. Should have a big thank you. You have a big thank you to mom and dad somewhere?
They're in the credits, yeah. All food provided by Kathy and Chip Carruth.
All right. Well, thanks very much.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Our program here, Focus 580, made possible in part with support from the Art Mart in the Lincoln Square Mall, Urbana. The Art Mart is pleased to support public radio in East Central Illinois. The show is also made possible by grant from Bodywork Associates this year, celebrating their 23rd anniversary. Bodywork Associates has been providing professional massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. Coming up a little bit later today as part of the Afternoon Magazine, Celeste Quinn will be talking with some more of the people who are here for the film festival. She will have two guests in her 1 o'clock hour. Jonathan Rosenbaum, he's film critic for the Chicago Reader and has written a number of books about the movies. And also joining her is Ken Winokur. He is one of the members of the Alloy Orchestra. It's a 3-member ensemble that writes and performs live accompaniment for silent films. And as a part of the festival, there will be a showing of the silent film Phantom of the Opera, a great film with Lon Chaney, and the Alloy Orchestra will be performing the music live with the movie. So that's pretty cool. So they will be talking about that coming up on the Afternoon Magazine today. The show, as usual, gets underway at noon with news and sports, weather, other things. Following the 12:30 news, Ed Kieser will have the weekend weather forecast and also take your telephone call. So if you have plans to travel, you can call in, talk to Ed. He'll give you a forecast for your destination. And then some more talk about movies in the 1 o'clock hour of the show. We, in our next hour, are also going to have some more guests from the festival. We will be talking with an Indian journalist who's also done some acting in film and on the stage and has written about that. His name is Jerson DeCunha. We'll talk a little bit about Indian film. As you may or may not know, the Indian film industry is the biggest in the world. We'll talk about that and maybe a little bit about the potential for finding an audience here in the United States for some of those movies. Also joining us in the next hour will be David Poland. He is the editor-in-chief and publisher of MovieCityNews.com. It's an online site where people talk about and write about movies. So that's in the next part of the show. We're going to take a break here, as we usually do, for an update on the markets and news, so please stay tuned.
The Carl Center for Rural Health and Farm Safety is proud to underwrite agricultural programming on WILL. The center helps residents of rural communities with